This is the Library of Horror. Finally, a place where all of the living dead are welcome.
Good librarians, and welcome to episode number 2 of the Library of Horror podcast. You just got to hear a little bit of Dracula intro by our good friend, the Dunwoody. And then we got a song, our song, by T-Virus called Horror Night. And then coming up right away is a wonderful story by Lee Hartnup called Ignorance is Bliss. It's a long ass story, and it is kind of a zombie story, and I done said I wasn't gonna do zombie stories on Library of Horror, but this really isn't a zombie story. Well, you'll see once you get through the whole damn thing. I'll get a wonderful review from our friends at Sonar 4 on Wolves of War, edited by Eric S. Brown. Tonya Brown brings us a creepy as hell story entitled Dream Girl. And then, to fit the mood, we'll hear Sweet Dreams by Marilyn Manson. Maximum Pimpage, our first one for Library of Horror, is for Jonathan Moon's most insane novel, Heinous. And then we get a song by my friends from Pittsburgh, Deathmobile, called Invisible Bugs. The next story is by David Dunwoody, entitled Voice, and it's narrated by Tonya Brown. Here's a few out comments, and then a crazy as hell song by Lee Hartnup, who goes by Goat Boy on the forum. It's called Library Horror. So let's get started on this episode number 2 of Library of Horror podcast. You are welcome here.
Derek Edwards gazed out of the window of his flat to the streets below. Rain was hammering against the glass as though to smash its way in. Derek mused on this and couldn't blame it. Inside was good. Inside was safe. Inside was away from them. He could just about make them out far below, staggering through what was once a very busy street. Since the end of the world was announced, Derek had made provisions for isolation, such as food, water, batteries, well, you never knew when the television may start working again, and pills. Lots and lots of pills. Derek was not a stupid man. He knew that he could not last indefinitely in this little flat, and he was most certainly not going to set foot outside his barricaded front door. No, sir. The pills for when it all became too much. Looking down from his window, he couldn't help but wonder when that would be. Why the dead return to life? Why did they feed on human flesh? Why couldn't the government stop them? It made his head spin. He reached for the whiskey and took a deep swallow, relishing the heat that was temporarily spread across his chest. At last, justified reasons to start drinking again. It wasn't always like this, Derek thought. I used to be someone. This was true. Derek Edwards used to be a renowned psychic. His speciality was psychic writing, where he would place a hand on the head of the subject and automatically write his prophecy. It was a gift that Derek was uncomfortable with, as he had no considerations of deity and the supernatural was laughable to him. And yet he had what his Aunt Pauline would call the gift. She would call him to her when he was young and say, "What you have is special, Derek. You must be thankful for it. Use it well. Your grandfather had it. Drove him to drink it, did. And I'd hate to see that happen to you." A misty look would come over her eyes whenever she mentioned Grandad. He took his life, and the family never really got over it. "Sometimes," his granddad used to say, normally when he was drunk, "you don't know what they're saying, and you don't want to hear what they've got to say, boy." "You use it well, Derek, sweetheart," his aunt used to say. "Don't hide it, don't try to understand it, don't try to stop it. Go with it and it'll serve you well." And serve him well it did. By the time he was 25, he was known across London. People would come to him and pay for his insights and messages. Yes, there were messages from the dead. They frightened Derek after death when they first came through. He never really got used to it. "I'd cope a lot fucking better if I understood how it worked," he would moan, whiskey in hand. "If you had any idea what it's like to have the dead chatting away in your head, you'd want to drink too," he would shout, as another admonishment over his drinking fell to his inscrutable logic. Derek made his money. There were offers on local radio, followed by television slots, a column in the national papers and so on. The problem with newspapers and radio was the fact that there was no human contact, and that was the catalyst for his gift to work. Human contact. Precious little of that around, Derek thought darkly, staring out of his window to the rain-washed dead below. He'd not spoken to anyone living for 3 weeks now. 3 weeks since the phone lines died. He'd been speaking to a radio presenter friend of his, asking how bad the situation was. "Get the hell out of Dodge," was the presenter's reply. Derek was about to inquire how many horses that would take when the line went dead. For 2 hours, Derek tried calling out. Nothing. Dead. Like them. They fascinated him. The dead, walking, cannibals. They scared him in equal measure. What a way to go, eaten alive by those things. He glanced over at his pills, already ground to a powder and placed in a small paper cup next to a glass of water. There was enough powdered sleeping draught there to finish him in 5 minutes. Swift, painless. That's what Derek wanted. The screams he had heard of the other poor souls dying at the hands of those monsters or anything to go by, that's the way he wanted to go. He remembered the news flash vividly. The newsreader kept looking off camera as though even he did not believe it. The dead were returning to life and eating the living. Madness, surely. Then more reports came in. Those who did not die after an attack became infected and died anyway. Then rose again. Within days, England was virtually overrun by these things. The military tried in vain, but to no avail. England became, in Derek's mind, a dance floor of the dead, and they were striking up the last waltz. He giggled at this absurd simile. "Exposure to celebrity does tend to make one a pretentious asshole," he muttered to himself, his breath fogging up the glass. He sat down on the settee and decided to lay siege to the bottle of whiskey. Why the hell not? The only way to sleep, he thought, as he brought the bottle to his lips. The sound of La Cucaracha was not the way Dirk expected to be dragged from his slumber. His mind took a while to focus. La Cucaracha? Through his fuddled brain came the words mobile phone. He leapt to his feet. Frantically, he located the source of the tune and grabbed the phone. He had not had a signal for over a week now. Had they got the signal going again? Was it over? These thoughts rushed through Derek's head like lightning. He pressed the answer button and pushed the phone to his ear. There was a small pause, and then he heard a voice. "Who is this?" the voice asked. Derek was dumbstruck for a few moments. His heart thumped in his chest. Is it over? Have they stopped it? "Can you hear me? Who is this?" "This is Derek Edwards." Who's this?" "Mother's maiden name and paternal grandparents' surname, please."
What do you mean? Look, who is this?"
"Mother's maiden name and paternal grandparents' surname, please."
Turner and... Shit, he stumbled for the name. Hartnup.
"Thank you, Mr. Edwards. One moment, please." The line hissed with static, and for a heart-stopping moment, Derek thought the connection was lost. Another voice came on the line.
"Mr. Edwards, this is Major Henry Wharton. Are you in a secure location?"
Derek looked around. 8 floors up, hallways barricaded, lifts out of order. He shrugged.
"As secure as it's going to get. What's going on? What's happening? Is it over?"
Derek's heart was beating faster now. He felt itchy all over as a sudden surge of adrenaline coursed through his veins.
"It's over. They found a cure."
No, Mr. Edwards, it is not over." There was a pause. Derek felt a swift wave of nausea and sat down heavily on the settee.
"This is stupid," Derek thought.
"What do you want?" he asked.
"We have orders to come and get you, Mr. Edwards. We have our location pinned and we have your location now. Please pack only what is necessary. Expect us within the hour.
We're coming to get you, Derek." The line went dead. Derek sat in a daze.
Coming to get him?
His mind struggled for and missed a reference that would have made him laugh in other circumstances.
Coming to get him? How? There must be thousands of zombies down there.
Suddenly, Derek did not want to leave the safety of his flat. For over 3 weeks it had been safe, and now he had to leave. He shuddered.
Expect us within the hour.
Well, Derek thought, time to pack.
Where the hell are they taking him?
Derek grabbed his black sports bag from the airing cupboard and began to pack furiously. Underwear, socks, jeans, t-shirt, jumper, whiskey. He smiled as he put the bottle in, wondering if there was going to be contraband in effect wherever he was going. He went to the kitchen and pulled his toolbox from under the sink. He took the long screwdriver and the short-handled claw hammer and placed them under his t-shirts. Insurance, he thought. Walking back to the lounge, he reached for his whiskey, sat down on the settee, and waited. The first sound he heard was a low thumping hum. Derek stood up and walked to his window. The rain had softened to a light drizzle. Looking upwards, Derek saw the empty grey sky. Large, darker clouds were beginning to gather again in the north. The thumping sound grew louder now, and Derek ran to the kitchen window and craned his neck upwards.
There. A helicopter was approaching.
This must be it, Derek thought. His heart began to race again, making Derek's stomach roll over and his knees go weak. He noticed his hands were shaking.
Shit, what the fuck was he doing? This place is as safe as it gets. He must be insane to leave here.
These thoughts raced through Derek's mind. Suddenly, he really didn't want to leave. The sound of the helicopter grew louder. Suddenly, Derek's blood ran cold.
This is it, and he'd almost forgotten.
He grabbed the bag of powdered sleeping pills and shoved it into his trouser pocket. The real insurance, he thought. The phone rang. Derek's heart jackhammered in his chest.
Hello? Yes? Mr. Edwards?
Yes? Step back from the windows. Derek looked up and saw a pair of heavy-booted feet appear at the top of the window frame. A soldier was being lowered down on a winch outside.
It must be on the roof, Derek thought.
Suddenly, the soldier kicked the large window. Glass shattered everywhere. Derek leapt back as the soldier positioned himself on the ledge, then climbed into the flat. He looked around swiftly. It was only then that Derek saw the soldier had a large pistol in his hand. After a few moments, the soldier looked at Derek. Derek guessed his age to be about 43. He was roughly 6 foot and heavily built. His eyes, however, looked as though they had seen a lifetime. "Hello, Derek," the soldier said.
"You alone?" Derek glanced round despite himself and said, Yes, I am. What's going on? You're being rescued, Mr. Edwards. Do you have your gear packed?
Derek nodded, grabbing his bag.
Good, not too bulky. Now, I want you to put this harness on.
The soldier reached behind him and unclipped a large leather harness. Derek slipped it on over his shoulders and clipped it together. He looked expectantly at the soldier, although he knew what was coming next.
Right, now face me and clip the hooks in the eye hooks on the front of my arm. Yep, that's right, yep. Now, step up onto the ledge as I do. Ready?
He looked at Derek.
Listen, you're safe. These things are tough as steel. Now, on my count, we step off the ledge, okay? 1, 2, 3. With that, Derek stepped off the ledge and swung into thin air. He noticed that the soldier was signalling upwards, and Derek saw another soldier leaning out of the door of the large helicopter that was hovering 70 feet above them. Through the deafening roar, they slowly began to rise. The wind and drizzle hit Derek hard. He seemed suddenly frozen to the bone and started to shake all over. Another factor of the shaking was the enormous amount of fear he felt. He was outside, where they were, the last place he wanted to be. Slowly they reached the helicopter, where they were dragged inside by rough hands. Derek heard the soldier say something to the pilot, and with a tilt, the helicopter flew onwards into the coming night.
Cheese and pickle or ham and mustard?
Derek looked up at the soldier. He'd just removed the harness and was sitting down.
What?
Sandwich, Mr. Edwards. Cheese and pickle or, cheese will be fine, thank you.
Derek eagerly took the offered sandwich and started to devour it hungrily.
Fresh bread. He'd not realised how long it had been since he'd eaten.
Steady on there, the soldier said. You'll choke yourself.
He grinned. Derek laughed, embarrassed.
Thanks. You don't have to call me Mr. Edwards. My name's Derek.
The soldier held out his hand and said,
Well, Derek, I'm Captain Barlow. You can call me Ed.
Derek shook Ed's hand. Looking out of the doorway, Derek felt very exposed. He never wanted the helicopter to land.
Ed?
Yeah?
What happened? Out there. What happened? Ed let out a long sigh. Running his hand through his hair, he looked at Derek.
Well, we don't know, mate.
Derek's heart sank.
Of all the people who would know, the military were the ones Derek would have put his money on.
Shaking his head, Derek said,
Where are we going then?
Ed looked at Derek for a second, then looked out at the helicopter into the coming night.
Somewhere safe.
Somewhere Safe was an ancient Napoleonic fort on the River Medway. Overlooking the river and Rochester and Chatham, this brooding labyrinth had stood guard like a sentinel born of the earth. Set into a hillside, the fort seemed to grow from the grass and trees. Small concrete walls and doorways gave way to huge banks of earth and foliage. It was not hard to cover these from prying eyes. Part of Captain Edward Barlow's job had been to disguise all entrances to the fort and to erect barricades on all perimeters. From one of the nearby army barracks at Chattenden, bulldozers and other industrial vehicles had been utilised in the fortification of the perimeter. Captain Barlow had read up on the history of the place. This was to become a haven from the undead, better to know all the secrets. Fort Amherst was constructed in 1756 to defend the southeast approaches to Chatham Dockyard and the River Medway against a French invasion. The fort was enlarged and strengthened during the first few years of the 19th century, during the Napoleonic Wars, as the Chatham defences were considerably enlarged. There was a maze of tunnels dug into the chalk cliffs, which were used to move ammunition around the fort. The fort was still in use during the Second World War, and restoration was still in progress. Doors had been fitted in those first hectic days. Every entrance had been secured, then camouflaged. This haven, Barlow had mused busily, was by invitation only. Barlow was not privy to the guest list, but he had been sent out on missions to pick up chosen survivors 3 times already. Mr. Edwards, it seems, was a last hope, judging by the briefing he had received. Major Henry Wharton sat in his office, smoking a cigarette and watching a television screen. There was a knock at the door. He sighed. The door opened and Captain Barlow marched up to the desk and snapped off a swift salute. Major Wharton returned the courtesy and gestured for Barlow to take a seat.
Have you seen this?
He said, nodding towards the television. He watched Barlow closely. This could become a very delicate issue for morale. The television was playing a videotape of a documentary. On it, a man was being interviewed about clairvoyance and profit.
The man being questioned seemed to be taking it in good spirit. Do you recognise him, Captain? Barlow rubbed the back of his neck.
He does look vaguely familiar, sir. I know I've seen his face, but I really couldn't say where from.
Major Wharton lit another cigarette, offering one to Barlow, who declined.
When the shit hits the fan, I'll need all the puff I can get, he would say to his subordinates.
Major Wharton took a deep drag, slowly letting the smoke out through his nose onto his moustache. He seemed to Barlow to be making a decision of some kind, and not an easy one at that. Finally, he said, "Are you a superstitious man, Captain?" Barlow was a little taken aback by this question.
"Not particularly, sir, no.
This chap on the telly,
you say you recognise him?" "Well, I've seen his face, sir, but like I said, I can't really remember where from.
Captain, the man on the television is Mr. Derek Edwards. Ring a bell." Barlow thought for a minute.
"Yes, and the medium. The one the scientists hated because they couldn't disprove him or something."
"The medium, sir?"
"Yes, Captain. The medium." Wharton paused, looking down at his cigarette. "It would seem, Captain, that our Mr. Edwards has been granted an invite." Barlow's mouth dropped open. Slowly, he started to shake his head.
"You have got to be kidding."
"Captain, you most of all should realise that we have to take everything into account. Every avenue must be explored in this case. With the situation outside these walls growing at a geometric rate, we can afford to overlook nothing.
But a medium? Has it come to this?"
Barlow stood up and paced the room, shaking his head.
"Surely it hasn't come to this. The medical bods, the scientists, they must be making progress. Bloody hell. I mean, we get them enough."
"Enough is correct, Captain. Now, sit down." Barlow sat down, his head bowed. He reached over and took a cigarette from the packet. Wharton lit it for him.
"Ed," he said, "God knows this isn't easy. You must see it from the higher ground. Every possible explanation, however bloody ludicrous, has to be explored. That's why tomorrow you go and bring him home."
"So, what do you know about them?" Derek asked as the helicopter jogged and jarred. The main part of Derek really did not want to know. He had managed to distance himself from them since the onslaught. He figured that to think about them too much would invariably drive him insane. He looked at Ed.
"Well, they're dead. They eat the living. And you can kill them by shooting them in the head or destroying the brain. Oh, and they're thick as shit, but bastards in numbers. Look, Derek, all you need to know... there's nothing more than that, really, but I'm just not the bloke to ask. Trust me, you'll be briefed as soon as we get there."
"Where?" Derek said, getting anxious about his destination. He put his hand over his pocket and felt the package against his thigh. At least at the flat he was never anxious. There was only one way out from there, a nice, peaceful way. Now he realised it was open to nastier ways out.
Shit, if he'd have acted sooner, he could have made a run for it in the early days. Fuck, he was rich enough. He could have chartered a plane to some nice tropical island.
"Derek, you soft git," he mused to himself.
"There," Ed said, and pointed to a small light in the distance. For the first time, Derek realised how dark it was outside. Not nighttime dark, pitch black. The light he was watching was nearly the only light out there. His eyes scanned the sky and the ground below.
"Power has been out for 2 days now," Ed said. "So we only use one light to land by, that and the night vision goggles. Doesn't do to advertise any more than we have to."
The helicopter slowly lowered to the ground. Derek looked around. He stepped out of the helicopter and onto the tarmac. Peering into the night, he could make out trees and large bulky shapes. The wind howled at him as he looked out across a river. He was high up, he figured, looking out over a series of towns far below. The moon was coming out now, briefly darkened by clouds scudding across the night sky, silver in the lunar glow. It seemed to Derek that even the moon was afraid to show its face or draw attention to itself. It was so quiet. Derek jumped when Ed put a hand on his shoulder.
"Whoa, easy there. Don't worry about it. I'll be jittery too. How long are you in that flat?"
"Since it began, really," he smiled. "Not much human contact, shall we say."
What a blessing that was too, thought Derek. Human contact. That was a thing, wasn't it? His gift. Touches the living, hears the dead. Wasn't that how one reporter had put it?
Of course, they'd all gotten it wrong, as usual.
His gift was the ability to channel the dead through the living by means of a phenomenon called automatic writing. He would place his hand on the head of a subject, and then a click, a link. Derek didn't know what the hell it was, or how it happened. But the fact of the matter was, as Rennie did, he would begin to write. Messages from the other side? Shit, he didn't know where it came from. Which, as Derek knew very well, was a lie. He knew he could channel the dead, he just didn't like it very much. He did not like the fact that when the link was made, he was lost. He never knew what he was writing because he, Derek Edwards, was not there. He seemed to slip into a trance. He remembered very little about these trances, but what he did remember scared him. One moment, there would be a slight tremor in his arm, then bang. He was reading what had been written to an incredulous and, of course, well-paying client. But he would then have to go and have a very strong drink because while writing, during that trance, Derek thought he could see the writer. He thought that term less unnerving than ghost. He never told a soul about this facet of his gift, but some of them did not die well. "Come on then," Ed said. "Let's go." "Where?" asked Derek. "I can't see a bloody thing." "Third bush on the right, and straight on till morning," Ed laughed, and led Derek through a door hidden behind a large bush. They stepped into a large tunnel. Ed turned and closed the iron door, sliding bolts against the top, middle and bottom by pulling a lever on the wall. As they turned and stepped forward, suddenly they were bathed in light. "Sensors." "Don't worry," Ed said as they walked along the tunnel. It seemed to Derek that the tunnel had been dug into chalk. The white lumpy walls soon gave way to red brickwork, which looked just as ancient. He looked around at the curving ceiling. It was not very high, really. It seemed like they were in a warren. "What is this place, Ed?" he asked. "A Napoleonic fort. It runs right under the Great Lines." "Sorry, the hillside we landed on." Local term. "The tunnels go on for miles. Every entrance is fortified. We have our own power supplies, as well as food and water. It is old, though. In fact, this year it is exactly 250 years old. They were going to have a huge celebration here before, well, before the world went to shit, really. But that's all in the past now. No good dwelling on it. I've seen too many good men swallow the barrels of their guns through dwelling on things they can't change. Oh, not those things get me that way." Ed had set his jaw and stepped up the pace. Derek felt guiltily at the package in his pocket. "Anyway," Ed said, "I think it's time for you to meet the boss. He'll give you a brief. His name is Major Henry Wharton. Ah, here we are now." Derek saw two guards at the end of the corridor. They were stood either side of a large iron door. Derek noticed they were carrying some rather large rifles and sidearms. They saluted Ed. "Security go, please, Captain." Ed rolled his eyes. Protocol be fucked. They knew who he was and who he was with. He began to notice his own insubordinate tendencies more and more as of late. He was a soldier, for Christ's sake. Time to get a grip. The guard handed him a small flat device with numbers on one side. Ed entered his security code and handed it back to the guard, who slid it into a slot beside a door. It opened with a low hum. He gestured Derek to follow him. The fort on the other side of the door was a place of steel and bright lights. The walls were flat and smooth, and they stretched off into the distance. Doors and corridors appeared on either side as they walked on in silence. Suddenly, Ed stopped and knocked on one of the doors. They heard a muffled voice inside say, "Come." He opened the door. They walked into the office. After an exchange of salutes, Ed turned to Derek and shook his hand. "I'll catch up with you later, Derek." "Don't worry." And with that, he left the room. Derek looked over at the man standing behind the desk. He was about 60, but looked good for it. His hair was iron grey and he had a small, neat moustache. It reminded Derek of the actor David Niven. "Mr. Edwards, please do take a seat. I'm Major Henry Wharton. I trust Captain Barlow gave you a brief rundown of the situation." "My God," thought Derek, "he even sounds like him."
Well, in a way, Major. The captain said you would brief me." Derek slumped into a chair.
"So, Major, what the fuck is going on?"
Major Wharton sat down in his chair and sighed.
"How much do you know of what's been happening, Derek?" he asked.
"All I know is the dead are rising and eating people, and you can only kill them by blowing their brains out."
"That is the most succinct description I've heard yet,
But, he sighed, rubbing his hands across his face, I feel bad to tell you the full story. Not that it in any way invalidates your own summary. Major Wharton stared into middle distance as if he were reciting a London Underground timetable. He began. Reports of violent attacks in Middlesex were reported on the 24th of September. Attacks of a mob nature. Similar attacks reported in 37 towns. Don't look so surprised, Derek. The military have more surveillance than the CIA. It's all down to correlation of available data. Boring. Except this time it added up much too quick. On the 26th, riot police were called to 11 towns. Reports were coming in of people who refused to lie down when shot. We laughed at first. Bloody bad show, not playing the game and such like. Video footage of these things is an eye-opener to say the least. We saw them being shot, being hacked at, and still they attacked. On the 28th, we realised that those who were attacked in turn became infected. They died, and then reanimated. On the 31st, it was everywhere. There were incidents all across the British Isles. News coverage saturated the media. Everyone and their uncle had an opinion. On the 3rd, a state of emergency was announced. Curfews were put in place, safety zones were erected and manned, radio messages were broadcast. Unfortunately, they never knew what they were up against. You see, from what we can ascertain, it was too horrible for the men to contemplate shooting women and children. The fact that they were dead seemed to do nothing to strengthen their resolve. The fact that they were dead. We lost before we started. The safety zones were overrun or abandoned by the 8th. They didn't even last a bloody week. The Major lit a cigarette, breathed the smoke deeply into his lungs and held it there for the longest time, before slowly exhaling through his nose. He slowly shook his head and looked at Derek. By the 14th, there wasn't much of anything left. This you undoubtedly know. It is true that the only way to stop them is to destroy the brain. It is also true that they devour their victims. Why? We have no idea. They gain no sustenance for it. They do not even need to eat all of the body. We have no explanation as of why. Derek shifted in his seat. But what's all this got to do with me? He asked. If you would be so kind to follow me, maybe we can find out. He rose and gestured to Derek to follow him. They left the office and walked along the corridor. Major Wharton marched ahead, speaking to Derek over his shoulder. Derek, all I ask of you, for the time being, is to trust me. They passed two armed guards stationed outside a heavy iron door. Inside was a large room. It looked to Derek like a medical ward. It was brightly lit and smelt of antiseptic. Men and women in white gowns looked busy about their business, some laying out instruments, others filling out forms and paperwork. They paid Derek no heed. At the far end of the room, Derek could see a curtained partition. His heart started to pump harder. He looked at the Major. Derek, he said, you were rescued because of your gift. I believe you can use that gift, and I believe that we can make use of it. Derek felt that it was inevitable that it should come to this. Why else should he be rescued? Sure, he was modestly famous, but so was Ricky Gervais, and he didn't see him around. The gift. His eyes widened at the implication. He spun round to face the Major. Oh, fuck me, you have got to be kidding. Who's the subject? I don't think I can... Derek, you are safe. I told you that. Every precaution has been taken. Look. Major Wharton pulled the curtains back. Derek screamed. The workers in gowns looked up sharply at him, but Major Wharton raised his hand in a don't worry, go back to work kind of way. He put a hand on Derek's shoulder. Safe, Derek. Look, you're safe. Derek stared at the bed in front of him. Lying on the bed was a zombie. It was held down by large leather straps around its forehead, neck, chest, waist, thighs, knees, arms. Everywhere that could be restrained had been. Derek felt his gorge begin to rise. The thing on the bed was a man aged about 39. His skin was a whitish-green colour. The hands seemed too large. The fingernails were a dark yellow colour, deep red around the cuticles. The knuckles were also swollen. There was dried blood covering the hands and forearms. The stomach was swollen dramatically. Broken veins seemed to network the body, a dark red network of dried, dead blood. Derek could see the thing's back was black. The blood must have settled there and congealed. Its face was sickeningly mobile,
as it saw the two men for the first time. Straining against the straps, it opened and closed its mouth. The stench made Derek's gorge rise. The smell of rotting flesh mixed with vomit and Christ knows what else assailed his nostrils, making his eyes water. Derek saw its withered black tongue lolling about. It gnashed its jaws so hard that one of its teeth wrenched loose and fell to the back of its mouth, leaving a dark red hole in its gums. There was a movement there, and to Derek's horror, a maggot, slick with a putrid red sheen, undulated slowly out of the hole. He gagged. The zombie's eyes rolled in their sockets. They seemed blind, as there was no colour in the iris. Milky white cataracts seemed to watch them. The eyes moved in a jerky motion. Derek guessed this was probably due to lack of moisture. The bottom lip was gone. It looked like it had been bitten through. Derek stepped backwards. No, 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 no fucking way, no. Derek, we have no choice. We're at a loss here. We have exhausted all of our resources. For the first time, the Major sounded desperate. Do you really think that calling in a bloody psychic was first on our list? Damn it, man, can't you see how desperate we are? We're clutching at straws now. Anything that might help us is being sought out and utilised. Nothing is considered unimportant now. He stared at Derek. I'm asking you to help. He lowered his voice. Please don't force our hand. Derek realised the implied threat in his voice. Shit, he thought. This is it. You want me to do a reading on that thing? Yes. Is there anything you need? A paper and pen? Do you know how I do it? I understand you write messages that you receive via a psychic link. Well, that's pretty much it. I write a question and, well, it gets an answer. I don't know what I write, though. I go into a trance. He eyed the Major bitterly. It isn't a nice feeling. Derek prayed to himself, please, God Almighty, please don't let me see the writer. Please don't let me see the writer, please. Major Walton called for two armed guards. These, he explained to Derek, would point their guns at the thing's head at all times. Derek would be in no danger whatsoever. A seat was placed next to the bed. They handed Derek some paper and a pen. They watched him. The thing on the bed was making groaning noises from inside its rotted throat. Derek was loath to even look at it. With his heart in his mouth, Derek sat on the chair beside the bed. Well, Derek, old son, this is it, he thought to himself. The room was swimming in his vision. He needed to concentrate. He took several deep breaths. He regretted it as soon as he'd done it. Slowly, he reached out his hand. The zombie seemed agitated by his proximity. It tried to turn his head to bite at Derek. Straining, it opened and closed its mouth, biting off the tip of its tongue in the process. His head turned suddenly and sharply towards Derek as the skin on his forehead began to tear under the pressure. Jesus fucking Christ! Screamed Derek, snatching his hand away. Don't worry, said the Major. He motioned to white-gowned men, and then to the bed. They swiftly attached two braces to the side of the bed, fixing them over the zombie's skull. They covered its mouth like some awful external gum shield. Then they used a ratchet to tighten the brace. The Major looked at Derek. Please continue, Derek. He looked at the Major. What do you want to know? Major Walton sighed. He looked around the room and said, Why is this happening? He watched as Derek wrote the question on the paper. He took a deep breath and reached out his hand again. The skull of the zombie felt cold to Derek's hand. The hair was greasy and the whole scalp felt as though it was a size too big for the head. Derek concentrated. Here it comes, he thought, as a slow tingle made its way up his arm. Here it comes now. Shit, here we go, here we go. All aboard the Skylark, here we fucking go. The sudden force was like nothing Derek had ever felt before. Never had the connection been so strong as this one. His arm was a knotted tangle of muscle. How on earth could he be able to write with this much power? It was impossible. It was... And then Derek blanked out. Derek felt someone calling his name. He wanted to answer, but he couldn't move. He felt hands shake him. His name was being called louder this time. Derek! Derek, for Christ's sake, get the medics over here now. God damn it. What has it? How the hell should I know if this is normal or not? Derek! Can you hear me, Derek? Derek slowly opened his eyes. His whole body ached. His arm was thrumming as if he had done 100 pull-ups with it. Major Walton was kneeling over him. Derek, you okay? Did it work, Derek?
Give me a fucking minute, Derek mumbled.
He looked around and suddenly scrambled away from the table. With his back against the wall, he started to control his breathing.
That was the worst reading ever, he thought.
Major Walton walked over to him. Softly, he said, Well, Derek, did it work? Derek felt the piece of paper scrunched up in the palm of his hand. He slowly opened it, and with a sense of falling, he read it. After what seemed like an eternity to the Major, Derek slowly stood up.
Do you have any alcohol in your office, Major?
He asked. The Major nodded.
Yes, of course. Would you like some? I could send one of the men.
Derek shook his head.
Do you mind if I go alone? These things, well, they take it out of me.
He held out the piece of paper. Major Walton looked at it and then looked at Derek and said,
By all means, you know the way back, I trust. Whiskey, gin, vodka, all on the decanter by the desk.
Deal done, he took the piece of paper and unwrapped it. He watched Derek leave the room, noticing that he was gripping something very tight in his pocket. Shaking his head, he started to read. His eyes widened in horror as he read the words, written in an elegant hand, Why is this happening? Lust, sloth, greed, envy, wrath, gluttony, pride, rape, murder, ignorance, hate, neglect, spite, malice. I am the Alpha and the Omega.
And here we are, good librarians, at a new review of Wolves of War from our great friends at Sonar 4. The review states, Wolves of War is an anthology of werewolf stories compiled and edited by noted zombie author Eric S. Brown and published by Library of Horror Press. While Eric is known for his love of the zombie horror genre, he does an excellent job compiling and editing this collection. He states in his intro that his inspiration for creating this anthology was the movie Dog Soldiers, a standard I believe he has met or even exceeded, combining the horror genre. Werewolves in War resulted in some very interesting and unique stories. The cover art by Jody Lee definitely captures the essence of the collection. It shows a werewolf under a full moon with an ammunition belt wrapped around it, holding an automatic belt-fed rifle on its front cover. And on the back, the same werewolf, but now standing on a human body. It definitely gives a visceral feel of the collection of stories within. The authors of the stories for this anthology include A.P. Fuchs, David Dunwoody, Derek J. Goodman, Anthony Gregorio, Grayson Moran, Casey Quinn, Rhiannon Frater, Franklin E. Wales, John Grover, Timothy Long, Alan Mendoza, T. Patrick Rooney, Dylan J. Morgan, John McQuaid, Tom Brannan, and Victoria, Tim Curran, and Lee Plezers. This anthology brings a new slant on the werewolf, which has not seen the popularity of the rest of the horror genre of late. I believe this is a good start to reinvigorating the werewolf within the horror genre. The stories included in this anthology range from the basic werewolf to apocalypse, running wild on a Navy ship, in space, etc. With my background in the Navy, Adrift, a werewolf tale, The Werewolf on a Navy Ship was one of my favorite stories in the collection. I can't tell you how many times I would have loved to do some of what happens in that story. I don't want to spoil your fun in reading the anthology, but suffice it to say, the stories are well written and edited and really take the reader to new places in horror. The ideas represented by the stories are very original, definitely bloody and gory, and move the werewolf from the old days into the modern and future times and settings with an alarmingly scary degree of realism. I thoroughly enjoyed reading The Wolves of War, and strongly recommend that you go out and get yourself a copy. If you like horror, you'll love this anthology. Available on Amazon.com.
Dream Girl by Tonya Brown. Martin Dexter thought he had a good life. He had a fine wife who loved him. He had a well-behaved son, grown and gone. He had a job he liked, a few hobbies he loved. He had a home, two cars, and a small trailer on the beach in Florida that, although Maggie had to talk him into buying it first, he had to admit he was growing to like. And he had his dream girl. He loved his wife Maggie, and she loved him. They fought every once in a while, after which they would apologize and promise never to fight again. Only love, Maggie would say, only love from here on out. But Martin knew she wouldn't stick to it. She wasn't capable of it, but that was okay. That's what a dream girl was for. Have you got your wallet? Maggie would ask. Yes, love, he would answer. Have you taken your medicine today? Yes, love. Don't forget the oil change and new tires. Yes, love. And their life was like that, and he was happy, mostly. But every once in a while, his mind would drift to his dream girl. She never asked him if he would take care of the car, or if he had taken his medicine as if he didn't know he needed to. She never asked him anything. She was quiet, and that was good. She was perfectly quiet, and perfect just like that. But they, the family, always expected things from him. Dad, Robert would say, I need money for books. Robert was in college. College was expensive, but Martin understood the need of it. Yes, son, he would say, the money's on its way. Thanks, Dad. Can you spare more for shoes? Sure, son. Just keep those grades up. But his dream girl never asked for anything. She just took whatever he offered. No questions, no expectations, and no disappointments. She would look right at him with that faint trace of a smile and nod, maybe, if he timed his touch just right. Do you love me, Martin? His Maggie would ask. She asked this a lot. Over the years, he grew more and more tired of her doubt. You know I do, he would answer. I don't think you do. He never knew if this was a joking time or a serious time. Wives were funny like that. Wives were nothing like dream girls. I do, he would assure her. You know I do. I love you. I love you too, Maggie would say. His dream girl never weighed him down with love, or hate, or any emotion of any kind. She just welcomed his touch, if a bit coldly. But warmth, he knew, was reserved for wives. Sometimes the dream girl's faint smile would hint at the warmth she had left behind before she became his dream girl. It was her secret. It was part of her charm. It was what made her his dream girl, instead of just a mistress, or a lover, or a wife. Life would get hectic. Reports had to be filed. Phone calls had to be made. Bills had to be paid. The company picnic, bridge night, Maggie's parents visiting. Life could be hectic. Did you get those orders shipped? His boss would ask. Yes, sir, he would answer, knowing his boss already knew the answer. His boss just liked to hear Martin say it aloud. It was what he called validation. Martin hated validation. Sometimes he hated his boss, too. And his life. Well, just remember to fill out every form properly. You did an initial next to your signature on the last 3 order forms. Yes, sir. It's okay, Martin. Just don't let it happen again. Yes, sir. And it was times like this when he needed to visit his dream girl most of all. Even more than the doubting Maggie times or the needy son times. So, he would slip away from his normal life and he would go to her in that deep, dark place where she slept. And he would just hold her sometimes. And he would take her sometimes. But only when Maggie was away and Robert was at school. Because every now and then, the smell would drift up from the basement, no matter how much care he had taken. "I don't know what keeps you so busy in that basement," Maggie would say. "Just a hobby, my love," he would say, and it wouldn't be a lie. "Well, your hobby is attracting mice. Again. Sorry, dear. I think one of them's died under the floorboards or between the walls. I can smell it. Can't you smell it?" "Yes, dear. You're right, of course. I'll get rid of it tomorrow." And he would. Then, when it was time for bridge night again, he would stay home with a headache instead of joining the game. And later, he would go out to the darkest parts of the city, to the dankest streets, and there he would find her, standing on the corner with that faint trace of a smile hinting at her past. He would open his car door. She would get in. She would talk about money for the first and last time. He would pull the car around the back of the house, show her his basement where a drink was waiting just for her, already mixed. And after that, it was only a matter of time and skill before she would be home again. Then she would be his dream girl.
Everybody's looking for some. Maximum Pimpy.
Hello, good librarians, and welcome to our first Maximum Pimpage for the Library of Horror podcast. This one's on one of the most bizarre books that I've ever read in my life. It is absolutely, fantastically unique, strange, different, weird, and just all around right up my dark alley. It's called Heinous, and it's by Jonathan Moon. Haven't heard of Jonathan? You will. I guarantee it. Here's a little synopsis of the book that's on the back cover.
An ancient evil born in the fire, at the dawn of time, with an insatiable thirst for violence and fear. A monster, a demon, a god. Cursed with a weak physical form in our plane of reality, the nameless evil searches out morally corrupt or violence-inclined human host to do its bidding. It forces the human to seemingly random acts of violence, most often towards those closest to the host, before discarding them and searching out another to continue its endless cycle of violence. In 1995, it found such a host in Gavin Wagner. Merely being in the presence of the waiting evil awakens Gavin's own subconscious bloodlust. It possesses him physically, joining with him symbiotically, so that they share body, thoughts, and memories. Gavin witnesses the atrocities former hosts have committed, forced by the demon's power. Gavin struggles for control as the evil inside him grows hungrier, wanting him to kill those that he loves most. As Gavin's own bloodlust rises, he knows that they will not be enough for him or the evil. There is never enough agony for the thing inside him, his master, his friend. He names the nameless evil. He calls it Heinous.
And that's just a little bit about the book, good librarians. Jonathan has given me the opportunity to present part of Heinous on Library of Horror podcast. And it is absolutely a chilling story. Heinous is available on Amazon.com for purchase. And I think you ought to pick up one. John lives in the Palouse region of Idaho, Washington with his wife, daughter, and their dog. Heinous is his first novel. He's working simultaneously on a second novel and a collection of short stories. You can find Jonathan on MySpace at Jonathan Moon's Nightmares, where he's always looking for more horror friends.
We'll be right back.
Voice by David Dunwoody, as read by Tonya Brown. Why? Stephen jerked awake and lay frozen in the dark, listening intently. The apartment was silent, but he knew something had stirred him. It sounded uncannily like the voice of his ex-wife. Why? He stiffened. It was her. But it couldn't be. She was halfway across the country, as far from him as she could afford to be, and she wouldn't come back. Would she? Lying flat, holding himself as still as fear would allow, he rolled his eyes down towards the bedroom doorway, a black void from which the falsetto voice had emanated. It wasn't that he feared Sarah, but the idea of the woman standing in his home in the middle of the night, crying. It seemed crazy. It was crazy. And if it was real, surely it was the precursor to something much worse. Quietly, and with as little movement as possible, he slipped out from beneath the bed covers and crept towards the door, at an angle, so as not to alert her. He reached into the hallway and flipped on the light. There was no one there. He had a clear view all the way to the living room and kitchenette. There was only the bathroom, the closed door on his left, and, as he stood there in bare feet on the icy carpet, clad only in his briefs, hunched slightly as he listened, he heard the voice again, and it was coming from that room. No! The pitch of the strained cry was exact, just like that night, the last night, when he told her it was over and pushed her sobbing, protesting form out the door. Out to where? He had not known, or cared. She had family to help her out. He had nothing but the grating routine of their loveless marriage. Rid of her, he was without anything at all, and happy at that. Stephen grasped the bathroom doorknob and slowly twisted it. There were no sounds at all from within, no shuffling, no breath, nothing. It was as if he had been roused from bed by a memory rather than Sarah's actual return. Something about that resonated in him, and he grew colder. But he opened the door and peered inside. Empty. At least save for the shower, which had its curtain drawn. He flicked the light switch by the sink and whispered, "Are you there?" No response. He entered the room. The tile was colder than the carpet, making his toes curl. His fingers were already knotted into shaking fists. He knew the voice was real. Where was it coming from? He reached, trembling, for the shower curtain. If she was here, and in there, then there was no rational explanation. She was here to hurt him. God, he would have never thought she had it in her, but maybe he'd finally pushed her that far. Jesus, God, she could be right there, mere feet from him, separated only by a thin sheet, with a knife or a gun in her hands. Stephen raised his other hand over his head, ready to strike, as his fingertips brushed the vinyl. Stephen! He nearly jumped out of his skin. The strange falsetto had a tinny vibration to it. It was the vent cover, affixed to the wall above the toilet, rattling as the voice came through it. Stephen ripped the curtain back and stared at the empty tub. Why, Stephen? The voice was coming through the vent. He leaned in close to the grimy plastic cover, thoughts racing. Was the voice in the wall? Upstairs? In another apartment? The roof? What? Why? Why? He grabbed either side of the cover and tugged it. It came away with little effort, revealing a fan caked with black crud, behind which was a narrow duct that curved upwards. The whole thing was filthy, and a musty odor struck Stephen's nostrils. And something scrabbled up in the ductwork. He cocked his ear toward the open vent. There it was again, a light scratching. The bugs that infested this place. The thought of them clustering up here was nearly unnerving enough to make him forget the voice. Then, "You hurt me!" His head was almost right against the fan, and this time he heard the voice. He distinctly picked out several different tones. It was a chorus of tiny voices coming together in that odd falsetto which sounded almost like Sarah. Almost. But it was not her. It was an imitator. Imitators. No, she would never have come back. And now that he heard the voices clearly, they were not her own. This was a separate matter for which there was a rational explanation. Reaching for the fan switch, He turned it on. The vent spat black flakes in his face as the fan came to life. He spun away. For a second he thought the insects had come spraying out at him. Disgusting! More crud shot out, but he let the fan run, thinking it might somehow stifle the voices. If they knew he was awake, maybe they would fade away and restore the normalcy he expected of the waking world. After a few minutes he turned the fan off. The tile was littered with dark flakes that had come off the duct walls. He shook a few bits from his feet. "You hurt me!" The voices grew in volume, becoming unnatural as they did so. There was a buzzing underneath it all, a buzzing and scrabbling, and he started to think that maybe they were the damn bugs themselves. Blood-curdling, he threw open the cabinet door beneath the sink and rifled through its contents. It had to be something he could spray up here. He knew he didn't have any insect killer, but there was Windex. Bug killer for poor people. He snatched the half-full bottle and twisted the nozzle open. "You hurt me, Steven!" "Shut up!" he growled, and shot several streams of the blue fluid into the vent. It drummed against the ductwork. The voices grew louder. "Steven!" "Shut up! Go away!" He tore the top from the bottle and sloshed its contents into the vent. A storm of black, buzzing things showered over him. He threw the bottle with a sharp cry, flailing his arms about as the things, big, heavy bugs, bounced off his head and scrambled over him, their wasp-like drones filling his ears. And then they were on his ears, pushing their mandible and swollen heads inside and shrieking, "You hurt me!" He stumbled back into the door. It slammed shut and he fell onto the tile, thrashing madly. They were all over him. They were stinging. His face a rictus of pain, he screamed with all he had, but there was no sound to be heard in his head. No sound but the voices. "Why?" All the feigned human emotion left the cries, and they became an alien noise, little more than the frantic buzzing of insects acting out the anger and anguish they had been imprinted with. The years of Sarah sitting in here, on the toilet, sobbing and pleading, whether he was there to hear it or not, Sarah, irrepressible, who was never really gone. He beat his head against the floor. His eyelids were swollen shut, and he felt tiny legs clinging to the orbs of the eyes themselves. Felt this hot needle of a stinger. His head grew thick and heavy, and he was only vaguely aware when they poured into his mouth. Still he heard the voices. It was all he heard, until he didn't hear anything at all.
And that's it, good librarians, for episode number 2 of Library of Horror podcast. I hope you enjoyed all the different things that we put into this podcast. Coming up in future podcasts will be reviews of movies, reviews of books, lots more stories from Library of Horror Press, and also a presentation of some of Jonathan Moon's wonderful book, Heinous. So that's what you have to look forward to in episode number 3 of Library of Horror podcast, coming soon to a headphone on your ears. And I'd like you good librarians to join the forum, join in the fun, meet people that love the horror genre as much as you do. You can find it at www.libraryofthelivingdead.lafora.com. The link will be up on the Podomatic page. And now, as a little out song for the forum, I present to you a song by the strange as hell Goat Boy.
Hello, my little goat children. Uncle Goat Boy here, with a lovely little lullaby for all my darling goat children. on Dr. Pass's forum, 5,000 posts or more, will elevate your social state to that of a library whore. To that we all aspire, with more threads than a loom. We'll have their say till Judgment Day, this forum is a boon. Now Grinder's going to do a book about the homosexual dead, and TBE still shrieks with glee at the letters that he's read. Crucis seems to have his fun with his desert island ghouls, and Dancing Fred puts the shit to bed regarding forum rules. He's very forceful. There's zombie days and porn guides and baconology, and zombie science informs us of the dead's biology. There's zombonauts and fairy tales, dear God, there's so much more. And who do we have to thank for this? The good old library whore. He's a very dirty librarian. Ha ha.